There's just so many songs, and I'm very grateful that they made an album like Nirvana. I mean, imagine like even back in the 90s, a band releasing 18 songs. That's just so
I
exciting,
know. It's like unheard of. Talking Records Podcast. Talking Records Podcast. Talking Records Podcast. We talk about our favorite records. Talking Records Podcast. We're so glad you tuned in. Thank you all for listening. You showed up to the right place. Jed and his friends dive deep and analyze the records we have grown to love. We'll tell you how we found the band, then give you a track by track breakdown of all the songs. So grab your favorite beverage and pull up a seat. Today we'll look at another record in its entirety. Welcome to Talking Records. My name is Jed, and you're listening to a podcast that brings friends new and old together to talk about great records. I am absolutely thrilled to be joined today by my pal Ross. How's it going, Ross?
Thanks for having me, Jed. I'm very excited to be here. Thank you.
Or DJ Ross Star, as you've been known through certain circles.
You know what? I've been DJ Ross Star for so long that a few weeks ago out here in Nashville, I had a friend, and he was introducing me to another friend, and he wasn't sure. He had to pause for a second, and he said, "Do I call you DJ or Ross?"
Right.
And I said, "I guess whichever you prefer. Either one is fine. I guess I don't call myself DJ Ross Star Weekly anymore like I used to. So Ross is perfectly fine by me."
All right, I'll call you Ross. So tell us a little bit about that. You're no stranger to the microphone. You've been doing music shows, interviews for a while. How'd you get into that? Tell us about your show.
All right. So I grew up on Long Island, and I had a very small circle of friends that listened to pop punk. And this is in the mid-90s. So by pop punk, I mean Goldfinger, which I guess is kind of ska punk, Less Than Jake, sure. Bands mm-hmm. like that, Suicide Machines, which was a little bit harder, ska pop, like Real Big Fish, just the whole spectrum, MXPX, the Ataris, the nice. List goes on and on. My favorite band since 1994 is Green Day. Every time they would do an interview on MTV, whatever channel I was watching, I hated how the questions were so obvious. And I understand it's because they're appealing to a large audience, many of who probably don't know the answer already. And so for years, it bummed me out because I would listen to every interview Green Day ever did on the radio, on, international interviews. And the questions were always very similar. So I said, I really wish there was a show that existed where I could talk to these bands that I love and ask them like real deep questions. And I said, and it would be cool if like other music fans out there could send questions as well in case I either ran out of questions or I didn't know the artist that well, but I liked them musically and just wanted to get people to check out their stuff. I was known as that guy with the weird CD collection. My inner circle knew the same bands as me, but everybody else thought I was so weird because here I am with this walking around. I used to walk around my big CD book. I had CDs stacked on CDs because I would run out of room. And people had no clue who any of these bands were. Blink-182 and Green Day were the only two they recognized. And I just loved introducing people to music. I mean, this dates back to when I would go to sleepaway camp. They had a little radio station that you could listen to on campus. I did a radio show.
Oh, you played DJ on that?
I did a radio show at both camps.
Oh, that's amazing.
And then when I got to college, the radio station was there. And then when I got to college at American University, it was gone. They tore it down and they were going to rebuild it. So I had to wait a whole year at college for this station to be rebuilt. So the day it was open for business, I went in there and I said, "Look, I want to do this show. I feel like I've waited my whole life to do this. I want to interview musicians and do the show that I always wanted to watch that never existed." And so I was always good at hyping myself up, I guess. And I was able to convince record labels and publicists very early on to let their artists do my show, whether it be in person. Some artists would come to my campus in Washington, D.C., and they would come to my radio show and do the live interview. Some people would give me, press passes to go to the venues in D.C. and interview them there. Other people would call in live. And then when a big festival would come, like Warped Tour, they'd give me the press pass, and I'd go backstage with my little cassette recorder, and I would just sit there all day long doing interviews.
Just
Just firing them off.
Yeah, so I started in 2002 in September. The first show I ever did had the band Homegrown. They came in the studio.
Excellent.
And they did a live interview with me, and they played acoustic. From there, I became addicted to it. I loved having bands in studio. I loved having bands call in on the phone. And the coolest thing was, even though nobody on my campus really knew that I was doing a show, because technically you could hear it on like the TV station, but nobody really listened to that. However, there was the capability through the internet back then through a site called Winamp, W-I-N-A-M-P. And that was one of the first ways that you can stream something. And so my radio station, the general manager said, here's the link. You can actually give this to people. And if they open Winamp, the URL, they can hear your show. So I started reaching out to absolutepunk.net, punknews.org. There was like 15 other punk sites back then. And I would just say, hey, I'm doing this show. It's on this night at this time. Whatever, Taking Back Sunday's calling in. Almost overnight, people started listening because there was no show like this. And I knew that because I waited for it for like 10 years. So I was doing my own research, looking frantically for a show like this, and there wasn't one. I mean, I don't have like a plaque or anything that says you were the first one ever, but I'm pretty sure, as far as I know, I was probably the first live show weekly that had artists in like the pop, punk, and rock world calling in and coming in studio. I just loved the vibe of doing a live show. People would watch from all over the world, and I would let them call in and ask questions. I would let them send questions through the instant message. I did that for a good 15 years. I was too late to be on MTV, according to MTV, because they had already shifted to reality. And I was too early to capitalize on the internet, because back then, record labels and companies didn't have a budget for internet advertising. So I would reach out to labels that would send me all their artists, hundreds of CDs to give away. And I would say, hey, you know, do you want to do like, you know, do you want to run like a paid advertisement for like a month? And they would literally say, we don't have a department for that. Our budget our budget is Alternative Press Magazine, Fuse, maybe MTV2 if we have more money, and that's it. And other magazines. Wow. So and then it went from nothing to oversaturated. All of a sudden there were like a million shows almost overnight. So I did it for 15 years, and I interviewed everybody I've ever wanted to interview in my life. I did not interview Billy Joe from Green Day, but it's okay. I did interview
Mike Dirnt, though.
Yeah, that's on YouTube if you want to look that up after the show. And I had a great time, and I regret none of it. And I'm happy now to see people like you continuing on and exposing people to great music. And that's what I really care about. Still, to this day, you know, I'm 38, and I still love introducing people to new songs and new albums that I've been checking out that I really like.
Well, that's great, Ross. I knew when I met you that we were kindred spirits, man, cut from the same cloth.
Yes.
I understand you are a massive Green Day fan. How'd you get into Green Day?
It's hard to remember because I was 11. Me and my friends in class, we would talk about rock music. Back then, we liked Aerosmith, and we would just talk about anything we saw on MTV. That's what I would do. I would sit there and watch videos all day. I would record it if I liked it on my cassette player. I'm pretty confident I saw the Longview video, and I didn't like it.
Dude, didn't grab me at first either.
I remember. First of all, I thought they were British, and that was I said, "Who are these British guys? And what is this song?" I didn't like it. This is so funny. And I heard it again and again and again, and then something happened, and I started to like it, which is really weird. All of a sudden, I'm like, you know what? This is actually pretty cool. I think I like this song a lot. So I talked to my mom and I said, can we go buy the cassette tape? Lucky for me, we went to this record store on Long Island, which doesn't exist anymore. It was called Slip Disc. Really cool store.
Slip Disc.
They were like, you know, imports, Kerrang magazine, crazy rock and roll posters, like a real independent record shop. And I went in there and I, you know, my mom said, oh, he wants the Green Day album. And what did they say to my surprise? Which one? And I said, what do you mean, which one? And they said, they have three albums. And I said, there's no way. So I said, well, I want to get all three of them. We bought all three of them. I took them home. Nice. And I fell in love with Kerplunk more than Dookie and more than 39 Smooth. But the problem was that nobody at school believed me that Green Day had any other albums. And I didn't want to bring the cassette tape to school because I didn't want anybody to like steal it. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
So it wasn't until they did a news report on MTV with Kurt Loder where they were talking about the backlash from old fans calling them sellouts.
Yeah, the Gilman scene, yeah.
That people believed me, because on that news clip, there were fans holding up the Kerplunk CD, and they were showing like, oh, we were fans before Dookie, they sold out. And I said, look, see, I told you I have those albums at home. I told you.
There it is. I wasn't making it up.
And then the Basket Case video came out, and I thought that I thought was the coolest thing I've ever seen. And then they had then Woodstock happened. They had the When I Come Around live video. Then they released the official video. And then I just 24 hours a day, that's all I thought about was Green Day.
All right, Ross. Well, we are actually going to jump a few albums ahead. You and I are going to be talking about Green Day's 1997 album, Nimrod. Nimrod was released on October 14th, 1997 on Reprise Records. The band once again turned to Rob Cavallo to produce the album and set up in Conway Studios in Los Angeles. At a whopping 49 minutes, the album featured 18 standalone songs, including an instrumental surf song, an acoustic ballad, horns, and of course that signature Green Day sound. It is definitely an experimental album. They took their time recording it, too. 4 months were required to get this batch of songs recorded. The band had felt run down by constant touring, homesick and wary of the stadiums they were now playing. Nimrod seemed to mark an important change within the band, but if they were feeling strange about suddenly being labeled as rock stars, their actions in the studio seemed to suggest otherwise. Heavy drinking and mischief plagued the sessions. Rob Cavallo enlisted his own father to help keep an eye on the band while they were recording.
That's cool. I didn't know that.
The band took a more relaxed approach to the actual writing and recording of the album. Often, Billy Joe would work out a song on an acoustic guitar, and the band would add music around it. Drawing inspiration from The Clash's London Calling, the band wanted to break free of the three-chord mold and experiment with other sounds. According to Billboard magazine, Reprise president Howie Klein hung around the studio a lot. A total of 30 songs were recorded for the album, and the band picked 18. According to the Miami New Times, we had double the time, so we had double the songs. We had so many songs that we really didn't know what we wanted to do. We didn't know how we wanted to present this record, Armstrong explained. There was one thought. Let's just make another record that's sort of similar to what we've always done in the past. Another was, let's do something out of the ordinary and have like a double CD. But then the double CD thing started to become trendy, the Smashing Pumpkins and all these people. So what we did was just make one long record. So Ross, how did you get into Nimrod?
So Dookie came out, Insomniac came out. Nimrod, it was awesome for me because it was the only Green Day record that came out when I was in high school, which is like, that's like usually for most kids that grew up listening to pop punk and punk and rock, that's like their most awkward time of life is when they're in high school and they need music, you know, sometimes to help them through it. And Nimrod came out in 1997. I was 15 years old. I remember we were in a cab in New York City in August of 97. We were going to see Goldfinger play at a really tiny place called Coney Island High. It's a very famous venue, doesn't exist anymore. And they had on K-Rock, world premiere, Green Day, Hitching a Ride. And we almost, you know, we were screaming at the cab driver to turn it up. We couldn't believe, like, we were about to hear a new Green Day song. Mm. And we played the song. I think we kind of were familiar, even back then as kids, with the Stray Cats song. So we did notice that it kind of sounded familiar to the Stray Cats strut. But I remember first listening to Hitching a Ride was kind of like first listening to Longview. I wasn't really freaking out or anything. I wasn't like thinking to myself, this is the greatest Green Day song I've ever heard in my life. I think up until that point, I feel like the label, in my opinion, was not very good at picking singles. I mean, for Insomniac, Geek Stink Breath was the single. I didn't think that song was that great either.
It didn't well yet.
You know, and I hate to keep going back in time, but you know, in 1994, before Insomniac was released, they went on the MTV award show and played Armitage Shanks, which I think is a way better song than Geek Stink Breath. I think that's a way better song than Geek Stink Breath. And I thought that was going to be the first single, and then it wasn't. And it never even became a single. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how these record execs picked the singles, but yeah, so Hitching a Ride, I was like, okay. It's pretty interesting. Everyone was making a big deal at the time that there was like the violin in the song. But I mean, it's in it for like 2 seconds. I didn't really think that was like a big issue. Mm. Everyone kept saying Green Day were experimenting and it was so crazy and they changed their sound. I said, this is like, I don't know why people are making such a big deal out of a violin. I thought it was cool. So then the album came out in October. And what's great is that back then, kids, albums used to come out on Tuesdays, not Fridays. And I had somehow won a copy of Nimrod off the radio of K-Rock because I used to call up for every contest ever that had to do with Green Day. And I won an advanced copy of the record. But what was cool about it is they accidentally sent the winners, the albums, a few days before a Tuesday. I don't think they were supposed to do that. So that Friday, I had the album before anybody else like that I knew of. Everyone else had to wait till Tuesday, like 3 days later. So I called my two friends in the neighborhood, and they rushed over. And we were just screaming and going crazy. And we had my little boombox. Well, I guess it was a big boombox. We put the CD in, and we just all sat there with our ears to the stereo. And then you just hear that freaking amazing intro to Nice Guys Finish Last. I just think that's such a great intro to a Green Day record. And the song just sounds like maximum Green Day. Somebody said to me, like, give me like five songs that you think have the signature Green Day sound. That would probably be on the list, you know, up there with like Welcome to Paradise, you know. As soon as that song came on, I said, okay, here we go. I knew this was going to be something crazy.
So Ross, we've actually done Dookie and Insomniac here on the podcast. And on those episodes, I kind of talked how I got into Dookie and I talked about, you know, coming to Insomniac and how much I loved it. But by 1997, I got to admit, I got to be honest here, Green Day was a little bit in my rearview mirror.
Wow.
Not because I didn't like them anymore. It's just that by then, I was like so heavily immersed in like Fat and Epitaph bands. I was really, really into ska in 1997.
Yep.
I was at local shows like every single weekend. I was getting into all these bands almost like on a weekly basis. And so some of these bands that I had been listening to prior kind of took like a back seat to that. My arrival at Nimrod is funny because I basically ignored it when it came out. I had no interest in it. I didn't pick it up. I had heard Hitchin' a Ride and I wasn't too wild about it. I was just so focused on other things that I think it was months before I even listened to it. So it came out in the fall, and by that spring, I was going over to my buddy's house every day to play video games. We were playing this game, Ken Griffey Jr. Baseball, right? And he had one CD at his house, and it was Nimrod.
Amazing.
So, and I have no idea why, of all the CDs, like of all the records, why he just had this one album. But he had Nimrod, right? And so we used to throw it in, and we used to listen to Nimrod every day while we played this stupid baseball game on Super Nintendo.
Awesome.
You know, after like a while of listening to it, I realized that I really, really liked it. It was diverse. It was kind of weird. It was long, you know, but the sound was punchy. The songs were great. It was, you know, it was Green Day. Now I got to be honest, it's definitely one of my favorite Green Day albums. Insomniac will always be my favorite. Sometimes I say Nimrod's my second favorite.
Interesting. I have never had it as a favorite or as my least favorite. I've always had it in the middle for me.
All right, man, let's get into these tracks. Yeah. Here we go. The first song on the album starts off with Nice Guys Finish Last. And you had mentioned that it just starts off with a bang. I always love this song, and it serves as a nice bridge between this album and its predecessor, Insomniac.
Yeah, it shows that they still had it, that they were still going to make that kind of music, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing is, back then, I wanted Green Day to make Green Day sounding music.
Right.
Now that I'm older, I want them to experiment. Back then, I didn't want them to go too far off the path of what, to me, Green Day did best. Make, you know, killer pop punk songs. Not only do I love the song, but I got to see Green Day play right after Nimrod came out in New York City. They played a show at Tower Records, very infamous show now. I waited 9 hours in an ice storm, freezing cold. They let about 300 of us in. The band played on top of the staircase going up to the second level. And we were all on the bottom level. And this is on YouTube. You can look it up. Everyone's just moshing, having a great time. Of course, there's no cell phones back then or anything like that. and they opened up with Nice Guys Finish Last. And I remember I was 15 years old. I had seen Dookie and Insomniac shows, but with my parents in section 400. I don't even count those as real experiences. Here I am in a crowd of people around my age in New York City. Like, you know, I can't believe my parents even let me go there when I was so young by myself with my buddies. And here's my favorite band of all time at that point, playing a little show, opening up with Nice Guys Finish Last. And that show, Billy Joe comes down the staircase halfway through and he crowd surfs over us. And he goes over to the window and he spray paints F-U, F-U-C-K-Y-U, I don't think he cursed. And he drew on like the Foo Fighters Color in the Shape ad. They had like a giant ad on the wall. He like graffitied that also. That show is crazy. At the end of the set, Trey Cool throws his drum over the balcony, destroys thousands of dollars of CDs. They cancel the autograph signing after, and Green Day are banned from performing at any Tower Records for pretty much the rest of their career. Yeah, after that show. That was my first real Green Day show, I like to call it, was the free show at Tower Records. They only played 9 songs. Didn't matter, because that's like a crazy experience to be that young.
That must have been a crazy experience, man. I
see them play in a small room like that.
Yeah, and then just go nuts at the end. I had heard that they were pissed off because they had read a bad review of their record, and that's why they were all jazzed up that day.
Who knows? But, I mean, back then, waiting 9 hours for a Green Day show was considered insane. Now people wait 39 hours for a Green Day show to be in the front. But 9 hours back then was crazy. Like, we were considered nuts. Wow. We just wanted to get in. It was first come, first serve. You had to wait in line.
Oh, I'm envious of you, man. I'm envious.
Thank you. Just pays to be old and from New York.
Yeah. And in the right place. Anyway, this song's got the classic Green Day vibe with just great sarcastic lines. I love Trey's drums and Mike's bass. Everything sounds like really crisp. Billy sings, "Pressure cook and pick my brain and tell me I'm insane. I'm so fucking happy I could cry. Every joke can have its truth, and now the joke's on you. I never knew you were such a funny guy. Before warning, don't pat yourself on the back. You might break your spine." Just great, great writing. I just love his lyrics and his snide kind of sarcasm. It's just so good.
What's funny about it is in the music video, which I love, it's probably my favorite Green Day video they've ever done on any record. We used to joke about there's a part where he like forgets, I guess, what song comes next on the set list when they're playing in the video. And he opens his sleeve and he looks. And I remember we would pause that part of the video and the set list had like redundant and scattered and all these songs they weren't really playing on the Nimrod tour that we were going to. And we used to get so mad, like, oh, this set list is not really like showing what they're actually going to play. We wish they would play redundant and scattered live, but they're not actually going to. So that is a random fact that we used to think that was really funny. But yeah, I mean, I know the music video didn't come out when, you know, that was the last video they did for Nimrod. I'm surprised
It was like 2 years after Nimrod came out, they put that video out.
But that's my favorite video, and I think it makes the song even better than it already was.
You're talking about the football video, right? Yeah.
The Green Day Stadium, and they're like getting like the, you know, before the music starts, they're the coach
the
is telling them what
caster.
To do. Yeah. I think it's their best video still. I love it. So Nice Guys Finish Last is a great song. I'm 10 out of 10 for me with that one.
All right, let's move into the next song, Hitchin' a Ride. So we kind of mentioned this one in the intro, talking about, you know, how we heard the song and we weren't immediately grabbed by it. It was the first single from the album, as we mentioned, and maybe explains why I didn't jump on this album right away. I mean, I like it, but it's never been a song that's really done much for me. I mean, yeah, I wonder how things would have been different, maybe if Nice Guys had been like the first single or Scattered or something, but this one just kind of landed with a thud for me. I wasn't immediately blown away by it.
Yeah, well, what's funny about it is that not only did I not like the single, but then they put it in their set list forever, and they extended it to 20 minutes. So every show I'd ever seen in my life, basically, for 20 more years, had that song and the extended version. So there was no escaping it. I've heard it live like 50 times, probably. And I don't like it any better now than I did then. It's just okay. And anybody who listens to this that's like, you know, younger than us, they're going to get mad, because I used to be like, people that are younger than me, where every song Green Day did, I thought was a 10 out of 10. But now that I'm older, I have like, you know, my view has changed. I don't know if that's from being older,
a little bit more discriminate.
Maybe I'm willing to admit things aren't as great as I thought they were, you know, when I was younger. So
yeah,
Hitchin' a Ride's okay. I wouldn't request it. I wouldn't like play it for like someone who'd never heard Green Day before. I would probably just skip it.
And correct me if I'm wrong, you mentioned the 20-minute version of the song. The Nimrod tour is really when like Green Day started with the live shows, like the showmanship and the and the, you know, the extended songs. I mean, they did that with Paper Lanterns and all that stuff back in the day, but Nimrod Tour was really when they started to ham it up a little bit, right?
Nimrod is when they did that. That's when they started calling somebody on stage to play guitar for Knowledge, their cover of Operation Ivy.
I understand you've done.
Yeah, it took me a long time to get up there, but they started doing that on the Nimrod tour, having someone come up and play the guitar. So they had been doing that for a really long time until I got my chance to go up and do that. It was 8 years later until I finally got picked to play guitar on stage.
That's crazy.
But I remember back then, I was like, wow, someone's going on the stage. That's so cool. I would love to do that. And just never got picked until years later.
Hitchin' a Ride opens with a Middle Eastern-inspired violin performed by Petra Hayden of That Dog. It then descends into a very Stray Cats kind of vibe using, I think almost the same chords as Brain Stew. Are those the same chords? They sound the same.
Who knows?
It's the same pattern, but anyway. With phrases like happy hour and off the wagon, Billy is talking about struggles with alcohol, which was something he was dealing with at the time of the making of this album. The verses and chorus kind of play opposites. Billy sings, "There's a drought at the fountain of youth, I'm dehydrated, longing for a drink," but in the chorus, he counters with troubled times, "You know I cannot lie, I'm off the wagon and I'm hitching a ride." Pretty cool lyrical play there.
And the video is kind of weird too. I don't think the video helped the song either, by the way. Do you remember
it's
the
like
video?
It's a vaudevillian sort of stage.
Yeah,
act.
Yeah. It's a really weird video. I remember when I was little, I didn't really find it very interesting or at all. I just thought it was kind of strange.
Yeah.
I mean, going from like a cool video like Walking Contradiction to that, I just thought it was kind of weird. You know?
Yeah, it was definitely a weird video. Yeah, a better video to watch is the one they did on Letterman in 1998. They sound amazing. I mean, the sound is great. And Trey is just wailing on the drums. I mean, he's like, he looks like a maniac.
I think I know.
And the
best part
of the whole video is after they finish the song, he just like slithers over the top of the drums and goes running off like a crazy man. And Letterman just like loses it. Like he can't stop laughing. It's the funniest like video.
I think that was the first time he ever did anything funny on Letterman, and then that became the tradition. Every time they played,
and then he had to do
Trey
it.
Did
yeah.
something funny. Yeah, yeah, I do remember that performance. Yeah, I think Trey has like the little Nimrod, like not stickers, but like little globe hanging things, like from his drum
set.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. So the next song, "The Grouch," is a really awesome song. I love the way it just starts right in.
In high school, we used to do covers all the time. You know, at house parties and just everybody hanging out at someone's house that had instruments. And I'd sang. I never played an instrument really, but The Grouch was one that all my friends, even my friends that weren't super into Green Day, they just all loved it. And they all always wanted to cover it. So I used to just sing The Grouch all the time at all these little like get-togethers we'd have. That was everybody's favorite song. I think they thought it was kind of funny at the time too, lyrically, because we were young and it's just kind of like a funny song complaining about sex and everything else, you know?
Yeah. Staying young.
Yeah.
Not turning out like your parents.
I'm pretty sure I remember reading back in the day the song was supposed to be called Happy Grouch, and then they just changed it to The Grouch. So there you go, tidbit for you.
Billy sings, "Glory days don't mean shit to me. I drank a six-pack of apathy. Life's a bitch and so am I. The world owes me, so fuck you." He's bitter because life didn't turn out the way he had planned.
How much better could his life have been, honestly?
I know, but yeah, when you think about it. Yeah, I mean, people certainly get this way. And as Billy points out, they often blame everyone but themselves. When he sings, "Wasted youth and a fistful of ideals, I had a young and optimistic point of view," it's to point out how pure of heart he started out as, underscoring how bitter he's become. So it's kind of like a transitional type of life song, you know. Things didn't turn out the way you wanted. Now you're bitter and you're a grouch.
One of the Warped Tours I went to on the East Coast, they were able to play two extra songs. And Billy Joe said, "I have to play this song or Fat Mike will kill me." So Fat Mike's request was The Grouch. So I remember he played it at that Warped Tour. So that was pretty cool. And then in 2009 or 10, I got into Soundcheck for the 21st Century Breakdown Tour. If you had a Verizon phone, and you were able to find the Verizon truck that had Green Day on it, they would take a group of you backstage. Pretty cool. They did this every night of the tour, and they would let you watch Green Day soundcheck. So one of the soundchecks I went into, they played The Grouch. So that was cool to see it like so many years later, because they hadn't played that in like a decade at that point. So I've seen it a few times live. I know people always wish they would play that now, and they don't. But I got to experience the magic of The Grouch. I mean, there's videos online of them playing it. Pretty much sounds just like the album. They don't really do anything different to it. Just straightforward the grouch, you know?
One video highlight I saw was they played this show, Recovery. I think it was out of Australia or something.
Oh, yeah.
And they're interviewing. And so I'm going to back up a little bit. When you watch interviews with Green Day in 1997, they look bored out of their minds. I mean, you can tell at that point they are over it. They've been doing this thing now for a number of years. You know, they've done hundreds and hundreds of interviews. And I can just see it when I watch interviews from 97. They're just not into it. So here they are in Australia on this show Recovery. And at one point, they just get up in the middle of the interview and they leave. They go, you want to hear a song? And they pop up and they run over and they steal the house band's gear. And they just start playing this song. And the host is like, yeah, what are they doing? You can't do that. And they're playing, they play the grouch. And, you know, the distortion is all wrong. You know, the drum set doesn't sound like Trey's drums. It's a really interesting video. Definitely check it out on YouTube. It's hilarious that they just got up and were like, ah, screw this interview. We're going to go play a song.
If only I was older and my show had existed back then, perhaps they could have had a good interview.
Yeah. All right, man. So let's let's get into the next song. The next track on the album is Redundant. Choreographed in lack of passion, prototypes of what we were. Apparently, Billy and his wife, the relationship had gotten a little rocky at this point, maybe a little bit automatic. And Billy kind of wrote this song about those redundancies of life and how we all fall into this sort of this routine, you know, our daily lives kind of take on a redundancy. And the video highlights this as people go through the same movements on a loop while the band plays.
Redundant is a cool video. I like the colors. They pop. The song is good. I saw it live once in 1998 when they played Asbury Park with Sam I Am opening in New Jersey.
Nice.
I don't remember what it was like live, but I'm sure it was amazing because it's a great song. Mm. But they just don't play that one very often. But they maybe they should, but they don't.
They totally should. I always thought the video was cool. Going back to it for a second, it was actually inspired by the short that came out in the 80s. It was called Tango. You can find it on the internet. And it features characters moving through the same actions over and over as more characters are added. It's basically, you know, where the redundant video came from. It's the same thing. But this one is way weirder. And it's like 8.5 minutes long. And there's like full frontal nudity in it. And it's like this crazy, crazy video. Check it out. It's called Tango.
Tango.
The guy who made the film, I cannot pronounce his name. I won't even try. But check it out. Tango, 1981 short.
Good song, good video. Dita Von Teese was in the video. That was before she was well known.
Yeah.
And they used to play that one a lot on MTV. But it was never a big radio hit. Maybe it should have been.
Yeah, I like it now. You know, to be honest, though, in 97, it was a bit of a skipper for me. You know, it's funny how tastes change. You were saying that all songs used to be 10 out of 10s for you, and now you're a little bit more discriminate. I didn't really like this song that much back then. I love it now. I think it's a great, almost like The Who meets The Birds, kind of like jangle pop rock, you know?
I liked it because it was in my vocal range. Because I used to love singing in the car. Like I said, we would go to open mic nights at the local cafe and we would perform
and
like
redundant.
Different Green Day songs. And Redundant was nice. One of the songs that I could actually pull off. Whereas some of the other ones, when he sings in a higher pitch, I could never do properly. So I liked it because it was a good one for me to cover.
There you go. All right, Ross, so we're about to move into what I believe is both of our favorite song on Nimrod, so Scattered.
What a great song. Again, traditional Green Day sound, but it's just so great it doesn't matter. It's just so awesome.
It's vintage Green Day. I love it. It's super catchy. It's fast. Sure, it probably borrows from Sister Golden Hair by the band America, but whatever.
I don't know that song, but I mean, it definitely sounds like Billy Idol, and they even cover it sometimes now when they play Scattered live. They'll do the mix with Dancing With Myself in the breakdown.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
Scattered, I loved it from day one, and when they played it on MTV for the 1998 New Year's Eve special, it made it sound even 10 times cooler, that performance. And that's on YouTube, of course. And they still play it live today. They every couple of years, they break it out, you know?
Nice.
I think they're aware that people love that song still, so they do it, you know?
Yeah. And it's probably a good one. I mean,
I was going to say, it's probably easy for them to remember it, too, because it's not very complicated, you know? Just the three chords. Yeah.
But, you know, songs like this one and Nice Guys Finish Last represent what I loved most about this band. I mean, Billy just had a knack for picking up these great tunes and throwing them over power chords. I mean, they were simple. They were easy to remember, like you said. Yep. And these songs would just get stuck in my head, like, immediately. You know how sometimes you listen to an album and you get to the end of it and you're like, I don't remember a single song off that album I just heard? Green Day songs always just immediately stuck.
Yeah. I wish they made a video for Scattered. They didn't really push it or anything. It wasn't really considered a single. They just played it on an MTV award show. I mean, on the MTV New Year's Eve special.
It's like you said before. I don't know who made these decisions. I think Scattered would have been my leadoff single.
Maybe, I think because
or Nice Guys.
It's because they all sounded too much like the traditional Green Day sound. They probably wanted people that weren't into that sound to hear something different and want to check out the album, you know?
Trying to grab new fans, yeah.
Yeah. That's like, Scattered's probably for like the old school fans, like that, like that sound, you know? That's what I think.
And at first I thought it was about a girl, but as I read into it and I've read comments on YouTube videos and stuff, it might be about his father. I don't know. I mean, it certainly could, you could make a case for either one. I don't know anything about Billy's relationship with his father, but a quick read through the lyrics shows that it's definitely a song about missing someone and thinking about happy times of the past with that person. He reminisces loose ends tied in knots, leaving a lump down in my throat, gagging on a souvenir lodged to fill another year.
As far as I know, Billy Joe has said multiple times that Wake Me Up When September Ends was the first and only time he ever wrote about his father.
All right.
So it's probably just about an ex-girlfriend.
All right, let's move on to All the Time. Another great, straightforward tune.
It sounds like the Green Day sound, but I feel like there's nothing there to wow me.
It could have been on Dookie or Insomniac.
I wasn't wowed back then. You know, same thing as like I said before. I wouldn't like request it. If I was at an all-request Green Day show and they said, well, we'll play any song on Earth, I wouldn't think of All the Time. It's just kind of like, it's good if you're listening to Nimrod straight through, but I wouldn't like go to a jukebox at a bar and put it on. You know what I mean? And I've never seen it live. There's just one video of them playing it live from San Francisco in 97. That's like the only time I think they've ever played it live.
Yeah, not like a whole lot to it. Like I said, it sounds like it could have been on Dookie or Insomniac. Who knows? Maybe it was written back then. I mean, this whole album kind of seems like old and new songs reworked for the project.
Yeah.
It could very well have been something that they had lying around. All right, let's move into Worry Rock.
Here we go. A great song.
This is a huge song for me, too. I like this one.
It's just a really cool song because I don't really think I've heard any other song that they've done that sounds like this song. I feel like it sounds completely different than like anything I can think of off the top of my head. I think that if they redid it now, it would sound even better because I think his voice is a lot stronger than it was back then. Mm-hmm. So I would love to hear him do this song again, like a re-recording of it, you know?
It's definitely got like that pop drum beat.
Yeah.
Boom, bop, bop, boop, bop, you know?
Yeah. Weezer do a cover of it. I don't know if you've ever heard that.
Yeah, I have, actually.
I hated it because I don't really like Weezer, and they changed the lyrics to hugged instead of the F word because they don't cuss, and I thought that was really stupid, too. So I don't like the Weezer version, but some people probably think it's cool if they're, like, super Weezer fans, you know?
Yeah.
But I think it's a great song, and just like Scattered, it could have been a big radio hit, but then maybe that's why you and I don't work at a record label, because maybe we're wrong.
We're picking the wrong ones, or the right ones, or who knows. But
yeah.
I always love this song. I love the way it starts right in. Another sentimental argument, bitter love. And he says it again toward the end of the song when all the instruments drop out, and I just love that part when it's just the vocal, and oh man, it's so great. Another sentimental argument
and bitter love. That's why I want him to re-record it, because his voice, I think, is way better now. Yeah. So I think that one part would sound like insane.
It's one of a few relationship songs on here where people are at that point in the relationship where arguing and disagreement can lead to resentment and turning away.
Yeah.
This song kind of goes hand in hand with Redundant, describing that time when the fire seems to have gone out. Things are going nowhere. No one will take the fall, he says. But there seems to be hope at the end when Billy sings, promise me no dead end streets and I'll guarantee we'll have the road. So there's a little hope at the end.
Yes. I think that thing you do, the song, that thing you do, that kind of reminds me of Worry Rock. But Worry Rock came out first, so If anybody's copying
yeah,
anybody.
Yeah, kind of does sound like it.
If anybody's copying anybody, they...
I actually have that in my notes.
Oh, wait, really? Yeah.
I do.
Yeah, that's the only song I could think of that reminds me of that one. And it's funny because Billy Joe went and covered That Thing You Do, you know, for his covers record last year.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. That's funny.
So good song. Probably, you know, right up there with Scattered so far as like one of the better ones. Nice Guy, Scattered, and Worry Rock are probably my top three out of the seven so far.
Yeah, all great songs.
Next up is Platypus. Those lyrics were posted back in the day on the Green Day webpage before the album came out. And that was the only place back then that you were able to view them because they took them out of the lyric book. They're on the greenday.com website from like a million years ago, I remember.
Nice.
I think when I was younger, I thought it was the coolest thing ever because it was fast. It was punk. It was Jaded, real the fast, song. Yeah. It was Jaded the Song Part 2, but even wilder with deeper lyrics or darker lyrics, more cusses. But now that I'm older, I'm just kind of like, eh, I feel like it's not really that good. I feel like they were trying to do something, a different sound that they weren't usually that good at. In terms of that kind of Green Day song, I think that Jaded and St. Jimmy are way better songs than Platypus. Mm-hmm. I feel like those three are like similar. I would put that as my least favorite out of those three.
Well, to be honest with you, so I mentioned earlier that like, you know, we kind of had this on while we were playing video games. And it was fast. And I never really paid attention to it. It wasn't until I was in college when I heard a girl talking about all the swears in this song that I even really noticed. So, I mean, when you've got songs like Scattered, Nice Guys Finish Last, Worry Rock, and Uptight, you know, on this 18-track album, you know, they're totally going to overshadow songs like this one that I'll admit, I just, you know, I didn't pay close enough attention to it.
Yeah.
It was fast. That's all I really cared about when I heard it. It's got kind of an interesting backstory, though. I mean, rumor has it that it's about someone who used to review the band and then turned on them after Dookie. Some say possibly Tim Yohannan from Gilman Street. Not sure. Someone told me he once tweeted out and then deleted that it was about Tim Yohannan
from
Gilman Street.
I saw that tweet. He did.
Yeah. A lot of people point to the line, "I heard you're sick," as the definitive clue that it was aimed at Yohannan because he was actually battling non-Hodgkin's lymphoma at the time this record came out. So, you know, he's the guy that... they were pretty angry with for a long time because he had lots of not very nice things to say about Green Day and their being too poppy. And
again, a little embarrassing, but when you're 25 years old and you're Green Day, you think it's cool. But now I'm sure they probably think it's a little bit weird. put out that song. The last time I saw them do it was in 2010 in San Diego. There was a bunch of girls from Australia that flew to America and they went to like 7 shows in a row. And so they played it as a tribute to them because it's called Platypus, you know? And
nice.
It kind of fell apart towards the middle. It's on YouTube. I feel like they sometimes try to play these songs and they haven't practiced them in 20 years and they just don't remember how to do them properly.
Where does it go next? Yeah.
But it's funny to watch them try, you know. But yeah, again, I wouldn't tell people like, "Oh, this band Green Day is awesome. You got to hear their song Platypus." Like that wouldn't sell somebody.
You got to hear Platypus, man.
That wouldn't sell somebody on that kind of band, you know.
No. All right, let's move on to Uptight.
Great song. Great.
It's an upbeat. Great song. It's upbeat. It's kind of dark, though.
Oh, I think the music is great. I love the bass. I love the beat.
Yeah.
Never played live, ever. Not once on record. I think it's another really cool song, like Worry Rock. Really different. I've never heard another Green Day song that sounds like it. And I love the breakdown. Like the music, the guitars is so really cool the way it sounds.
Yeah. It's like they just had this part and they didn't really have any lyrics for it. So they're like, just keep it as an instrumental.
Yeah. Weird song. You know, could have been on Insomniac. Kind of like Babs Yuvalahoo or something. It's like there it's awesome. But like, I don't know if it necessarily stands out without the rest of the record. Like, I think if like you just heard Uptight today as a new song, you would be like, okay. But it fits in perfectly, I think, before Last Ride In, you know?
Which we'll get to in a minute, but I want to talk briefly about the song lyrics. I know Billy has been asked about whether or not the song is about suicide, and he has actually declined to talk about it, and for good reason. I mean, these journalists and music critics, you know, aren't familiar to him. So, like, why the hell would he start talking about suicide to some journalist or some critic, you know?
Yeah.
I love that he's just like, nah, I'm not going to talk about that with you, you know, like... It's a song I wrote. I put it out there for people to, you know, do what they will with it. I'm not going to sit here with you and analyze it, you know. So I think it was pretty refreshing to always hear him kind of downplay it or just kind of say, no, I'm not going to talk about that with you.
Yeah. I used to, when I was young and I had America Online, I used to always have the quote, I found my place in nowhere. That was always my favorite quote. And I had that in my yearbook quote. But then every so often, I would change it to the future just ain't what it used to be from Uptight.
Nice.
But then I would change it back to I found my place in nowhere. So I still like that lyric a lot from Uptight. I still do.
Yeah, strong lines. All right, man, last ride in.
We're halfway through already, almost. I think Last Ride In is cool. They did two instrumentals for Nimrod, that one and Espionage. They left Espionage off, and that went on to the Hitching a Ride CD single with Sick.
Mm-hmm.
I remember we went to New York City. We took a Long Island taxi to the Long Island Railroad. We switched at the train in Jamaica, Queens to take the train to Pennsylvania Station in Manhattan. Took a taxi to Virgin Megastore and found the CD single. Back then, it was a whole event to get a CD single.
Wow.
You could not just go. You couldn't just go on the internet like today and order whatever you want, you know?
Right.
There was really no internet, just eBay, and it was barely functioning.
You had to find that one store that had it, yeah.
You had to really work hard to find an import. And there were no stores like that on Long Island, so it was a whole day trek. And I remember we put on Espionage, and we thought it was super fun, and then it made it onto Austin Powers, of course.
Right.
I think Last Ride In is cool. I think it's catchy. I like the music video. I think the video is really interesting. A lot of cool clips of Green Day from like that era.
It's a surf song. You know, why not?
Yeah.
Throw a surf song on there. I like it. Like I put it on when I make like summer playlists and stuff, I'll throw it on there. I like surf music. I like this song as a standalone. Like if I had a single of it or a 7-inch with it on it, I'd like it a lot. I don't really like it on Nimrod just because like when I'm listening to this record and, you know, you've got songs like Uptight, you've just finished Platypus and... You know, you've got Jinx coming up and all these songs. It just kind of like, for me, just kind of drags down the flow of the record a little bit. I mean, it's kind of like a break. I get it. Like, I know people talk about, you know, palate cleansers all the time and all this. But I don't know. You know, when I'm driving to my car and I'm listening to Green Day and I'm listening to a bunch of these songs and this song comes on, I almost always skip it. Not because I don't like it, but I want to keep the party going, you know?
I get your point. I mean, maybe the point was that it goes into track 11, Jinx, and Jinx is so fast and upbeat that it, like, you know, it just like gives you a jolt of energy once that song kicks in.
Yeah, I love Jinx. Yeah, it's very Insomniac sounding. I mean, right down to the shoo he does in Armin Jinx.
Jinx, there's a video on YouTube that came out a few years ago. There's a recording of Billy Joe playing it acoustically on a KALX radio show in Berkeley.
That's cool.
So you can look that up after and you can hear him playing Jinx acoustic, which is the only time I know I've ever heard him play it live at all. So kind of funny that that's the version that's out there that's live. I think lyrically it's great. You know, very Green Day for, you know, what he was kind of writing about at the time, the darker lyrics. I think it's a good song and perfect to go into Hashinka. I think those two are just as good as Brain Stew Jaded or, you know, Chump Longview.
It's a song about that feeling that a person gets when they sort of decide to kind of give up, you know, say, fine, whatever. I'm not going to deal with this. I'm not going to get it right. You know, why bother trying? I'm done. You know, that feeling of just like, helplessness, you know, throwing your hands up and kind of quitting. Billy sings, so keep your distance. It's rubbing off or you will be damned to spend your life in hell. So it's like, you know, don't even come near me. I'm a Jinx, you know. And
in the lyric booklet at the very end, when he says, I'm a curse hanging around you. I remember that wasn't in the lyrics. It didn't have that part. And I wasn't, when I was younger, I wasn't too sure what he was saying. And I used to have those guitar tab books where they would show you how to play the songs on guitar and they would also have the lyrics to go along with it. And the lyrics in the booklet said, bad luck is centered around you. And I said, that can't be correct. It's definitely either I'm a curse hanging around you or not bad luck is centered around you. But that booklet, which was like
the same sound.
It was a real CD book, you know, a tab book. They still, you know, sell them. And I was like, this can't be right. Mm-hmm. That's just a random factoid I remember about that song.
Yeah, that's funny.
I definitely like it. Would I like it without track 12 Hashinka as the next track? Probably not. When I have it on shuffle and it goes from Jinx to anything else, kind of weird. Not as good.
Yeah. I mean, they belong together, yeah. So let's talk Hashinka.
This is a great
song.
This is probably my favorite one besides Scattered by far.
Mm-hmm.
This is like superior to anything else pretty much on there, I think, at least for that last part of the album. This song blows me away every time. I don't know why. It's just something about it, you know?
It's just great. It's got high energy. Hashinka is a girl with a peculiar name.
He met her on the eve of his birthday.
Yeah, so I guess this is an older song too, right? You were telling me that it's been around since at least Dookie.
Before. There's a video, an audio of them playing it in 1992. Isn't that wild? So he's had that song for a while. And then they recorded it for Dookie. You can hear the demo on YouTube. And then it didn't make it on that either. And then I guess they just wanted to put it on Nimrod, which was cool.
Glad they did.
The original one, which is the live version, you can hear lyrics are a little bit different. The music's a little bit different. So I always thought it was funny that when they put it on Nimrod, you know, the breakdown before the last chorus, just the same chords as Walking Contradiction, almost play the exact same speed. And I always thought that was weird that they didn't change it at all, you know? But I actually think that's kind of cool in a way, too. I almost feel like it was done on purpose, perhaps, but who knows? I think everything about the song is great. All the sounds in the background, the guitar, everything. That song I would love to hear live, but of course, never play it live. Only that one performance in 1992. Why? Who knows? I've requested it before. Trust me, I've yelled it out before and they don't play it. But great song. I would put that on my list of like top 20 of all time for sure. If someone made me make like a ultimate Green Day list, that would be on there. 100%.
Oh, definitely, yeah. It's just a great song. It's, like I said before, high energy. And I love the structure. I mean, I love how the ending bridge part, where the vocal pattern moves downward instead of the chorus pattern that travels up. I mean, they did all kinds of like really cool stuff with structure that always really grabbed me. I always thought that was really cool. Next song is Walking Alone. In retrospect, this song seems to prepare us for what would come next on Warning. It's a slower, more rock-oriented song. This song easily could have been on Warning, I feel like. It's got the acoustic guitars ringing out. It's got harmonica. I guess Billy Joe Armstrong picked up a harmonica, didn't even know how to play it, but was like, we're going to throw some harmonica on this one. Why not, you know?
Whatever he usually tries, he's good at, which is why I think he's so great. You know, like he plays a lot of instruments. I've seen him do it on some of those like behind-the-scenes videos, things you wouldn't expect him to play, and he's just talented at everything.
Yeah. That's cool. Yeah, I've seen him playing the piano and stuff. It's pretty neat.
Yeah, piano. Just I could fit on Morning, but I don't like this song. I'm going to go and say...
Yeah, not one of my favorites either.
I'm going to say it's probably my least favorite song on the album. I don't like the whole foot in a shoe. I think it's kind of... It just makes me feel weird. Like, you know, like, I know what he's trying to say. I just don't like it. I don't like the harmonica. I don't like the music. I just was disappointed when I was 15, and I'm still disappointed when I hear it now, especially because, like, Walking Alone, you know, the name could have been attached to such a cooler song. Like, I think of, I think of Walking Contradiction, great song.
Yep.
Boulevard of Broken Dreams, of course, I Walk Alone. Walk Away, which is on Trey from the trilogy, which I love. All these songs with Walk in it or Walking are all great. Even Pinhead Gunpowder, Walking Catastrophe off, you know, which is another song that Billy Joe sings. All great Walking songs. But then you have Walking Alone, and it's just a dud for me. So it ruins my legacy of songs with Walking in the name, you know?
Ruined. The streak is over.
I'd say it's probably my least favorite song on there. I mean, I that's probably the one I skip. You said you skip Last Ride In. I definitely skip Walking Alone. The second I hear the drum, I know what it is. I'm like, nope, next.
Nope. Next.
Sorry.
All right, moving on to Reject.
I think it was around Insomniac. This woman, like, I think she was a grandma or a mother. She wrote Billy Joe a letter because back then they had the address to send them fan mail. I think she was just complaining about, like, you know, them cursing all the time and their music. You can find this online. I forgot the details, but so Billy Joe wrote a response back that was similar to the lyrics of Reject.
Oh.
So the song was like the musical whatever that goes with the letter, telling her telling her to F off, you know? Like,
yeah.
Pretty much, that's what it was about.
You don't like my language?
You know, I've interviewed the All-American Rejects multiple times. but I can't remember if they admitted to me or not that that's where they got the name of the band from. I think they tried to tell me.
Yeah, I've heard that question floating around before. If they,
I think they told me they didn't, but I think they're lying. I think they told me that that wasn't.
Why would they? Yeah.
Where else would they have heard that phrase from before? You know.
Right.
And
it's in the song, yeah.
They played it one time live. I never saw it, but it's on the redundant CD single, live from Philadelphia. And on the, it's labeled as Reject All American instead of just Reject, but you can get it on YouTube, of course. The only live version that exists. Very standard Green Day, but I think it's pretty good. I like it. I think it's catchy.
Yeah.
Funny story. We always used to debate, me and my friend Chad, about what he says at the end of Reject, because we don't know. It's not in the lyric book. He says something, da-da-da-da. We went to a thing in New York City in 2010, a Q&A with Billy Joe for the, I think it was the New York Times. And then they did the fan questions, and Chad got up and said, what do you say at the end of Reject? And Billy Joe, he couldn't even remember which song that was. He goes, what song is that? And then he's like, and then he's like, oh, yeah. And he's like, I don't think I say anything. He couldn't even remember what the song was.
Well, there you go, folks. Hit us up on Instagram. Let us know what you think.
Yes.
He says at the end of Reject.
Let us know, Green Day Collector and everyone else.
Yeah. You know, it's pretty standard. I think on a, in an album with a lot of experimentation, it's nice to have a few of these tracks that just kind of, you know, the core, the backbone, you know? You got to have something like Reject before you go into something like Take Back, so.
Man, this song is I don't know what he was thinking about when he wrote this song, who he was thinking
about.
I'm not
wild about this one either.
What music inspired him, like what song he was listening to, or he said, I'm going to make a song just like this. But it's just not good. That's not a good sound for him. I'm glad they don't have many other songs that sound like this at all. It's not even punk. It's just like...
monotone. It's weird. But I'm wondering, my theory is they were in the studio. I mean, I could be way off. I don't know. I think they were just in the studio and they were goofing around and they were just jamming on something. And they like, I think this is like they recorded it on the spot, put the whole thing together as they were doing it. And someone said, oh yeah, that's funny. Let's get it on the record. Because it's just, I mean, there's nothing to it. It's just fast. Yeah. It's like he just sings it straight through. It's it almost sounds live. I mean, you can hear feedback when it starts. I mean, it doesn't sound like a whole lot of thought went into this one.
I like the end, like the shit. I like that yell.
Yeah.
But that's about it.
And the final stretch, King for a Day.
It's become a staple of their live set. So for every 20 minutes.
Another one where they kind of like keep it going and going and going. I mean, it could get to 20 minutes, right?
I've seen them do it probably 50 minutes, 5-0, where they let single member of the band, including the touring members, come out and do a song and dance, you know, during the breakdown of the song. Because they play a bunch of other covers in between the beginning and the end of King for a Day, you know.
Right.
They do Shout. They do Shout, and they have each member come out and sing part of Shout. And it's just like the part of the show where, like, if I wasn't so into being in the front row, that would be the point where I would go get a beer or go to the bathroom or do anything else but watch King for a Day live. But I understand why they do it, because for people that don't know all their songs, that's probably the most fun part of the show.
Sure.
That's it.
Yeah, it's wild.
See them dress up in costumes, play covers, in between. Have like, it's just like a fun song. You know, Jason Fries comes out and does the saxophone solo, and they have all the instruments going on. I get why people like it, but if I had one wish, it would be to never see it live ever again. I think they've been doing it for 24 years, but I get why they'll never stop doing it.
Yeah.
You need that thing in your show that makes people who don't know all your
weird
cuts.
Participating.
I think people see King for a Day live and they leave saying, wow, that was a great show because of that song.
Yeah.
Musically, it's fine. Sounds like Girls by Beastie Boys to me. I always thought it was just like, you know, they're ripping off that. I thought it was cool. I thought it was cool. They got one of the guys from No Doubt to come in and play the horn on the record.
Two of the guys.
Yeah.
Gabrielle and Steven. Yeah.
That's true. Yeah. They took one of them on tour, and they took Scott from Real Big Fish on tour at one point to also play live with them. I just remember seeing it live in 97 and thinking, this is funny, than doing this live, but they're not going to do this live ever again. little did I know it would go from Billy Joe playing a little kazoo to like having a whole 30-minute version of the song live on stage, you know?
It's a fun song. I remember at the time being annoyed in 97 because it came with, you know, people called it ska because it had horns. And I'm like, this is not ska. If anything, this is like country, you know, because it has like a ding, 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 or polka. It's definitely not ska. That used to drive me nuts when people would talk about how it was ska. But I liked it because I had actually read an interview with Billy Joel where he's talking about, here's a quote where he goes, "It would be funny for a bunch of macho fraternity guys to be singing along, and little do they know, the song's about being in drag." You know, Green Day got so big that their crowds got so diverse that, you know, there were large crowds of people there that probably sang songs to songs they didn't know what they were about. And it's nice to know that he took a little bit of pleasure up on stage getting these guys to sing a song about being in drag.
And yes, I will confirm that when they did play it live back in the 97, 1998 years, I did see him get into it with Leopard Thong, which I didn't really want to see, but he definitely took off his pants to perform live, and you saw him in his thong in real life.
Wow. Well, there was a show on the Dookie Tour where we played completely naked, right?
He had Madison Square Garden. That was like 3 days after the first show I ever went to in Nassau Coliseum. But you couldn't really see his butt. But these tours, he made sure you saw his thong.
Oh, all right. He turned around.
Yeah, and there's definitely a lot of photos of it too, laying around, floating around. Yeah, another one of those Green Day trying something new songs. It's fine. It's catchy.
Yeah.
You know, I don't dislike it. Like I said, any fanatic will tell you, you know, when you go see them live, they could fit seven other songs in the time frame that they do King for a Day. But I'm pretty much convinced
that's what I would rather see. Yeah.
I'm pretty much convinced they will always play it forever until they retire. So I just have to accept
it. It's probably fun.
I just have to accept it.
All right, Ross, good riddance.
Do you know how mad I was when the video came out and they changed it to Time of Your Life, parentheses, good riddance? They changed the name of the freaking song because so many people referred to it as Time of Your Life and they didn't want
people wouldn't be able to figure out what it was. Yeah.
Exactly. So let me tell you, so Good Riddance came out on the Brain Stew Jaded CD single in 1996. Along with my favorite B-side they've ever done, Do Da Da. I remember I got the CD single. It was the first time there was ever like a Billy Joe ballad, basically. Unless you consider Words I Might Have Ate on Kerplunk a ballad, which I guess it kind of is. So Good Riddance came out. Oh my goodness. I cannot tell you how much I loved that song on that CD single. I was obsessed. And I didn't even understand why, because at that point I never liked anything that sounded like that. It was just something about his voice. It was like a deeper tone, the way he does that version.
So take the photographs and still frames in your mind. Hang it on a shelf of good health and good time.
The guitar just sounded really cool, and I just thought it was an amazing song. I made sure that everyone in existence that I knew of listened to it. I used to cover it every time we'd go to that open mic night I mentioned. I was obsessed. And then... For a year and a half, I was obsessed. And then all of a sudden, I found out it was coming out on Nimrod. And I thought, of course, it was going to be the same version of it. And then when it came out and it was completely different, I was surprised, me being, you know, that guy, you know, who prided himself on finding things before anybody else. You know, I would, you know, I used to say, oh, this was the best version of it. But I can honestly say now, years later, I still think the Good Riddance Brain Stew Jaded CD single is the better version of the song. So I can I could say that it actually is better. It wasn't just me being young and trying to be cool. That's what I think.
Trying to be there first. I think it's a good song. I try not to let outside influences, you know, shade whether I like a song or not. Like, you hear people all the time say, oh, I don't like it because it's overplayed. I try not to do that because, like, I don't care, like, you know, what other people think. And I don't let other people influence whether or not I like a song or not. This one, though, I did get tired of it. I mean, it was, when I first heard it, I liked it. I liked Billy's voice. I thought the orchestration was cool. This was like kind of before every band in the whole world put orchestration on their albums. I thought it was neat. I thought it fit great on this record because the record was pretty diverse. But after a while, like, I just couldn't take it anymore. I just got burnt out on it. You know, it was popping up everywhere. I mean, this breakup song was popping up at graduations. It was school dances. I mean, it was on the freaking final episode of Seinfeld.
Yeah, it was.
I was like, all right. I've had enough, you know? So I don't skip it, but it's definitely not. I don't seek it out anymore. I just kind of feel like, all right, yeah, kind of done with it.
I just didn't like it. His voice changed because, you know, he was singing a little bit higher to fit with the melody. Mm-hmm. I like the
plus you were used to one thing, yeah.
Yeah, I like the you know, and then live, you know, when he would play it, it would be kind of like a mix, I guess, because he would just play it by himself at the end of every show with the acoustic.
Yeah.
And he would kind of play it faster, but it was kind of like not, it didn't really sound like either one, you know?
Yeah, I'm sure his adrenaline was high. He probably wanted to get through it. Yeah.
Yeah, and they still play that live. Not every show. You'd be surprised. You'd think he would play it live forever, but some shows they don't do it. But most of them they do at the end, you know?
Well, final verdict. I like it. I got a little sick of it. You know, sometimes when it comes on in the right moment, though, like, I'll be feeling it. You know, put a few beers in. I might, you know, throw my arm around a pal and be like, this is the greatest song ever, you know, but.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, it's Green Day.
I mean, it was good for them because if not, they may not be around today. That really helped, you know, they really helped them become big again. They were almost done at that point, I think.
Right. I mean, yeah, it did kind of propel them back into
That was definitely
the spotlight. And then just the way it took off and how everybody was using it for everything.
Track 18, Prosthetic Head.
Finally to the end. Last track in the album. Weird title.
Yeah. It was a single, not really a big single. They played it on a couple of shows, like late night shows. I think it's okay. I think I did a little tidbit in the breakdown. I think it's around the 2 minute mark. You hear him cough in the background. Billy Joe coughs.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't edit it out, which I think is funny. I like the way it ends the album. Like, I like how, like, the just the end of the song in general, how it just, like, ends and that's it. You know, I think it's, like, a really powerful ending to the record.
Yeah.
I don't know what else I would have picked as a final song.
Yeah, hard to pick a final song for this record. And I think they got it with this one, because I do like the way it kind of builds. It's a song that kind of builds in intensity. You know, it's got some great clean guitar and amazing harmonies, and they kind of go into, like, the loud chorus. Again, it's got kind of a lengthy wordless bridge like they had done earlier. And then you're right, it just kind of carries the album to a close, and I think it does what it needs to do.
Yes. And also, you know, not on the record, we talked about it off air, you had your favorite B-side, Suffocate.
I love Suffocate. It's just so catchy. I just always loved that song. I always tell people my favorite Nimrod song is not on Nimrod.
It's so weird, like, how they took it off. That song and Desensitized were supposed to be on Nimrod up to the last second.
So yeah, much. I don't know why they took those off. I love those songs.
Desensitized was taken off at the very last second. And that's why if you look in the CD booklet under, like, the band, it says Mike Dirnt plays bass, and it says in baseball bat, because on Desensitized, he's the one that destroys everything with the baseball bat, but it's not even on the record. So if you never listened to that song, you wouldn't have no clue what they were talking about. But that's why they took it off, like, right before. So you had those two. Off, you know, these are, like, the ones that didn't make the cut. You had You Lied, which is a pretty basic B-side sounding Green Day song. Rotting, which is probably the weirdest song they've ever recorded. That could be a whole other hour special on just Rotting. And that was it. And then I think that's it. And Sick and Espionage from the Hitching a Ride single. Mm-hmm. Those are the only two other songs that I can think of offhand that were, like, B-sides from that album.
Let's take a quick look at the artwork, Ross. So three art directors were rejected by the band, and pressing was behind schedule. Green Day asked the help of Chris Bilheimer, a friend of Armstrong's, who had done covers for other groups signed to Warner Brothers, records by REM, stuff like that. Having just the album title to work on, Bilheimer had some ideas. With the one that went through being inspired by a photograph Bilheimer saw, where a politician's poster had his face removed. He felt the image was striking and seemed to fit the band by featuring a typical middle-aged male, corporate politician, American kind of guy, and someone had completely taken his identity away through vandalism. Following that line of thought, Bilheimer took an encyclopedia picture of men in suits and ties and put colored circles reading Nimrod on their faces, using that to take away people's identity. The back cover had the same being done to a yearbook Bilheimer found in a Los Angeles bookstore. The booklet features the lyrics presented as if they were a secret document that had been redacted with black ink. The portraits covered on the album cover are actually Frederick Banting and Charles Best, two American-Canadian medical scientists who are most well known for discovering insulin.
Yeah, Green Day always had cool album artwork. They didn't blow it till morning.
In closing, Nimrod is the album that set Green Day up for the rest of their career. It allowed them to get creative without alienating fans. It might not have sold as many copies as Dookie, but but this album became the turning point that allowed for things like American Idiot, the Trio Records, and Father of All. It proved they could flex their creative muscles and move beyond three-chord pop punk. I was slow to get to this record. I was distracted by other things. But when I finally sit down and listen to it, over and over and over again, day after day, I realized what a great album it was. Lots of different songs, lots of diversity on the record. You had your pop punk, you had your acoustic ballad, you had your crazy polka with horns, you had a surf song. This is a great Green Day record. It's one that I come back to a lot and still enjoy. I'm not sure how strong my fandom would have been if the band had just made another Dookie or another Insomniac.
I think I feel the same way about Nimrod as I did when it came out. I thought it was great, but I never called it my favorite album. So I think Nimrod, like you said, was the first time they experimented. Some of the songs worked, maybe some didn't, but it's cool that they were so diverse, and Time of Your Life opened the door to Warning and let them, you know, do whatever the heck they wanted, you know, and they still do whatever they want. They make all different kinds of music, and I think Nimrod made them feel like it was okay to do that, whereas before they had to just do what, you know, what they thought they had to do, I guess, you know, make the Green Day sound. You didn't hear King for a Day before. You didn't hear Last Ride In before. You didn't hear any of those songs before.
All right, Ross, well, thank you so much for hanging out with me today and talking about Nimrod on this here podcast. And thank you so much for the tons and tons of great text exchanges that we've been doing for the past few months about Green Day and other music. It's been great getting to know you and chatting with you and talking music, man. This is what this is all about. And it's been a thrill to talk about this record with you.
You as well. Yeah, thanks for having me. And if you go onto YouTube and you search for DJ Rostar with three S's and put Green Day, so DJ Rostar Green Day, on YouTube, you'll find my interview with Mike Dirnt and the video of me playing guitar on stage from the Home Depot Center in 2005. And so you'll awesome. Find me in 1995 at my bar mitzvah, which is a Jewish tradition, singing Welcome to Paradise with my friends as they took over the instruments from the house band. Those are all on YouTube.
Oh my God, I'm looking that up immediately.
Yes. Green Day DJ Rostar, Welcome to Paradise, 1995 at the Temple Israel. People were mortified.
Amazing.
If there's anything I want to tell the fans that are listening of Green Day, go back and listen to the trilogy. I tell everybody that I talk to this. I had two people do that, and they actually came back to me, and they were honest, and they said, I love it. You actually were right. I didn't give it a chance, and now I'm obsessed. So please listen to it.
Yeah.
Songs like Stay the Night.
I feel like I'm getting more into it the more I listen to it. I did, you know, it's so much music came out at once that I needed more time to just kind of, you know.
The last time I jaw dropped, well, Long Shot Record was the last time I jaw dropped, but before that was the trilogy. I loved almost every song.
I'd like to thank my man Craig for the graphics and all the help he does with the podcast. I would like to thank Chris DeMakes from Less Than Jake for the theme music. I'd also like to thank all of you for tuning in to Talking Records. It's a blast to dive into these fantastic albums, chat about the songs, and try to gather up all the information we can into one place. Check us out on the socials, say hello, suggest albums, tell us your stories. Listen to Nimrod on Spotify and Apple Music. Check out DJ Rostar's page, his shows, archived, lots of great interviews that span all the way back to 2002. Check it out. All right, Ross, take care, my man. Thanks for hanging out with me tonight.
Thank you so much. Boom, bop, bop, boom, bop.